At least 5 Israeli soldiers are injured, 3 critically in a retaliatory attack by Palestinians after the regime launched deadly raids in the occupied West Bank. Iran strongly condemns Britain's meddlesome statement on its latest satellite launch, calling it a sign of London's anger at Tehran's scientific progress. And Afghan girls find an alternative way to continue their education as the Taliban ban female students from attending schools. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: Israeli forces have killed 2 more Palestinians in their fresh raids on an area near the occupied West Bank town of Tulkarm. The victims have been identified as 23-year-old Abdurrahman Atta and 27-year-old Adnan Muhammad Faris. The 2 Palestinians were in a car near the village of Shufa in Tulkarm Governorate, where their vehicle came under Israeli live fire. Separately, Israeli forces have once again raided the Tulkarm refugee camp. The raid resulted in clashes between Israeli soldiers and Palestinians. According to Israeli media, 5 troopers were injured, 3 of them critically. Israel has intensified its attacks against Palestinians in recent months and has killed nearly 250 people, including children, in the West Bank. Iran strongly condemns Britain's meddlesome statement on its latest satellite launch, saying that it reflects the UK's anger at the Islamic Republic's scientific progress. Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said London's interfering remarks will not weaken the Iranian nation's determination to break new grounds in the fields of science and technology. He added that achieving scientific and research advances, including in the field of aerospace, is Iran's inalienable right. Kanani said the UK has a long history of taking hostile stances against Iranian people. He added that international laws put no restrictions on Iran's scientific activities, and the country is entitled to use peaceful technologies in its march towards scientific development. Iran successfully launched its Noor 3 imaging satellite last week. London denounced the move, saying that it proved Tehran's disregard for international restrictions on its missile program. Political analyst Bruno Baclini joined us earlier, saying that the UK is towing the US line over Iran's recent satellite launch and is trying to escalate tensions.
For me, they are speaking through Washington, provokes and trying to escalate tension in Middle East and trying to force a situation while watching the BRICS expanding and the Euro-Asian expanding in economics and in high technologies. That's for that. They are provoking. They are bullies, international bullies, I think so.
News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this segment of the program, human rights advocacy groups have condemned Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir's plan to authorize the use of live ammunition against Palestinian protesters. This after the regime's media reported that Ben-Gvir has already approved the use of such ammunition against Palestinians. Following the revelation, 2 rights groups declared that they would seek the protection of Palestinian citizens through the United Nations and other international organizations. They also denounced the regime's deliberate inaction on the rising crime rate in Palestinian communities, which has so far claimed nearly 200 lives since the beginning of 2023. Back in August, Ben-Gvir said his family's right to safe movement in the occupied West Bank was more important than those of Arabs. His remarks came after recent resistance operations across the Palestinian territory against its decade-long occupation by the Zionist regime. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist, author, and activist Fra Hughes, who's joining us from Belfast. And we also have co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mr. Mick Napier, who's joining us from Edinburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Hughes in Belfast. Let's jump right in. First of all, I want to get your thoughts on the recent comments made by this far-right Israeli minister, Itamar Ben-Gvir.
Well, I'm absolutely not surprised by anything I've heard. And in fact, more importantly, it's not his words, but the deeds of the Israeli army on the ground in the West Bank. and the continuing ethnic cleansing day by day, the theft of land, the theft of homes, the theft of water resources, and the murder of Palestinians who physically protest against this illegal occupation. I think we are just witnessing a continued further move to the right by both Israeli society, which is represented by the Israeli government. There is already a shoot-to-kill policy in operation. We have seen Palestinians who challenge the illegal occupation shot many times. A knife is thrown beside the body in order to try to justify the murder. The person is then allowed to bleed out. I've seen videos of young men and young women shot by the IDF, and they have refused to allow medical services to attend the scene. So it's very reminiscent of the racism of North America. I mean, we all heard stories growing up, and indeed I'm sure it continues today, where police officers in the United States carried a second weapon, and if they shot a black person, they just threw the gun beside the body and said they were defending themselves. So it's a continuation of the racist, xenophobic aspect of Israeli society, that the only good Palestinian is a dead Palestinian, and Israelis and Jews that live there will only be safe when they have exterminated or expelled the remaining Palestinian population. And the UN will not come to the aid of the Palestinians. Neither will America, neither will the EU. The Palestinians only have their own physical bodies. They only have their own moral strength. They only have the strength of God, and they have the support of the resistance of Axis, the Axis of Resistance. This is all they have going forward to try and protect their homes, their lives, and their families.
Mr. Napier, our guest in Belfast is not surprised at all by these comments coming from the likes of Itamar Ben-Gvir, but it does delve deep and exposes the hostile and murderous mentality of these Israeli ministers, doesn't it?
They are openly genocidal. They openly wish to kill as many Palestinians as possible. And they openly want to remove virtually every Palestinian from Palestine. There's nothing furtive about it. They discuss it openly. And when the human rights groups clutch at straws and talk about the UN being called in to protect Palestinians, it's understandable that people should look for help from anywhere. But the record of the UN in protecting civilian populations is not a good one. And they won't even admit the reality of what's happening on the ground, never mind do something to improve it. I mean, I just happened by coincidence to have been with Richard Falk, the UN Rapporteur for Human Rights, a day that his study on behalf of the UN concluded that Israel was an apartheid state from the river to the sea, that Israel was indeed a crime against humanity. Now, that report was published bravely by some people inside the UN, but it was very quickly suppressed from on high following massive US pressure and threats. So the question of agency is very important. Fraz dealt with it in a sense by talking about the Palestinians have their own ability to resist against overwhelming odds, and they have allies throughout the region. So Ben-Gvir, before he went into murderous politics, he lives near Al-Khalil Hebron. He had a picture on his wall of Goldstein, the Zionist murderer, who slaughtered scores of worshippers in the mosque in Hebron. He had this picture on his wall, and he said he was a wonderful moral man. Now, the picture's gone, but Ben-Gvir has now been put in charge of an armed militia, the biggest armed militia inside Israel, and he's murderous. He's openly murderous. This is only going one way. Now, I have to say two things. One, Israel's always been murderous, but the openness and the kind of blood thirst that you can see at the moment is to some extent new. And Ben-Gvir will not be stopped until a superior force stops him.
Thanks a lot, gentlemen. Mick Napier joining us from Edinburgh, and Fra Hughes speaking to us from Belfast. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but stick around, there's plenty more to come here. Moving on, as the Taliban have banned Afghan girls from attending schools, a TV channel in Afghanistan is offering an alternative way for students to continue their education at home. Sahar Afghanistan TV, launched by Iranian Sahar Network of TV channels, has initiated a program to provide education to Afghan girls and boys through their TV screens. We have a report.
This is how Nida and her sister, Zinat, both students of secondary school in Kabul, spend their mornings. They sit in front of their TV and follow the lessons of Maktab Khana, a program launched by Sahar Afghanistan TV channel, affiliated with Iran Sahar Network. Maktab Khana, which means home schooling in Persian, covers different subjects from secondary school. The students can watch the lessons on TV or access them online through the channel's website and social media platforms.
A friend of mine introduced the homeschooling program on Sahar TV to me. Since then, I have been following our lessons every day. It helps us learn from home. Its schedule, teachers, and syllabus are great. I recommend all my peers listen and watch this program at a time when we can't attend our classes at school.
Sahar Afghanistan TV channel says it is trying to fill the gap created by the closure of schools, especially for girls who are banned from attending classes by the Taliban. This program is also said to be the best of its kind, benefiting from prominent teachers, high graphic, and engaging methods.
The Taliban decision to ban girls from going to school not only moves Afghan girls backward, but has also concerned Afghan families. So, as a media outlet, Sahar Afghanistan TV channel found it necessary to provide Afghan students with educational programs, initiating the homeschooling program. It is going to be a ray of hope for both female and male students in Afghanistan.
The program was launched based on a realistic and functioning strategy. The top Afghan instructors are teaching in the program. The best visual qualities and an engaging method, as well as a student-friendly environment, are used in the program so that the students enjoy and like it.
The homeschooling program has received positive feedback from many Afghan students, parents, and educators who see it as a lifeline for learning in a time of crisis. Taliban authorities banned Afghan girls from attending secondary and high schools 2 years ago. Since then, Afghan students have been struggling to find and try alternative ways of learning. In a country where millions of students are deprived of education, Sahar Afghanistan TV channel's homeschooling program represents a ray of hope. Afghan students welcome the program, calling for an urgent reopening of high schools for girls. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Over a dozen people have been killed and more than 100 others, including army personnel, have gone missing in flooding in northeastern Indian state of Assam. The incident happened early on Thursday after heavy rain caused a glacial lake to burst its banks, triggering flash floods down a mountain valley. Floodwater surged into residential areas where several houses collapsed. Army bases and other facilities were damaged and vehicles were submerged. Roads and bridges also washed away in many areas. Search and rescue operations are underway. The disaster, which has affected thousands of people, is the latest in a series of deadly weather events in South Asia blamed on climate change. Moving now to the Chinese city of Hangzhou, where the 2022 Asian Games are underway. Iran has sent 289 male and female athletes to compete in 34 sporting events. Our correspondent Salman Kujri joins us now from the Chinese city with the latest on the competitions there and the medals Iranians have won so far. Salman, over to you.
Well, Verdi, today was a gold day for Iran, a happy moment for Iran, as we had expected. Actually, two gold medals were backed and snatched by Iranian wrestlers in 130-kilogram category in Greco-Roman. Amin Mirzazadeh, after defeating his Chinese opponent, backed the gold medal. Also, in 97-kilogram category of Greco-Roman, Mohammad Hadi Staravi snatched the eighth, actually, gold medal for Iranian team, as we expected. So wrestling brought us two gold medals, and, you know, Greco-Roman competitions have come to the end, and from tomorrow we'll have freestyle wrestling beginning, so we expect more gold medals to be backed by Iranian wrestlers in freestyle wrestling as well. Also, today was a history-making day for Iran again, and that is in skating. First of all, let me say that Tarana Ahmadi claimed silver medal, and this is Iran's first medal in roller skating in women's inline freestyle skating. Tarana Ahmadi claimed silver medal. And another piece of good news, actually, good piece of news is that Romina Solik, another skater, freestyle skater, Romina Solik, has set a new world record in speed skating at the Hangzhou Games, clocking a time of 4.254 tenths of a second. So this is a new world record, and that's a huge achievement and success for Iranian camp, especially Iranian girls, and this time at Hangzhou Games. This has happened. Romina Solik has brought honor to the Iranian camp by setting new world record in freestyle skating. And this shows how much dedication and also skills she has. Also in skating, in men's skating, we have Reza Lassani, who finished fourth, and Elnaz Rekabi in climbing also made way into the semi-final. Generally speaking, according to the medals table, actually Iran so far by having actually won 8 gold medals, according to the what we have, of course.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the representatives of the people from the provinces of Sistan and Baluchistan and Fars Khorasan. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 11, 2023. We must pay careful attention to what is happening and know what we are doing. We should know what we are saying. The things we say should not help the enemy's scheme and help complete the enemy's puzzle. At times, a person may be neglectful. They may do something or say something that helps complete the enemy's puzzle and scheme. This is dangerous. We must be careful that this doesn't happen. If we are vigilant, the enemy will not be able to do a damn thing. During these 40-some years, today's enemies and the enemies that existed before but have ceased to exist, like the former Soviet Union, treated us badly and did whatever they could against us time and time again. The Iranian nation was awake. It was alert. It was following the objectives of Imam Khomeini. Imam's guidelines are valuable for us today as well. See what Imam was saying, what he wanted, and where he was leading us. The nation did this, and that is why it has succeeded up until now. The situation is the same today. We must be vigilant today as well.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The enemy has targeted two fundamental points. One is national unity and the other is national security. National unity is important. Do not let them destroy our unity. What is the meaning of unity? It means that with regard to the country's fundamental issues and in areas where the interests of the nations are at stake, religious differences, political differences, differences between groups and ethnic differences should be put aside. Everyone should be together. Different ethnic groups and different religions should be together. In places where there is a specific orientation, this unity is important. And with regard to security, those who threaten national security are the enemies of the nation. They work for the enemy, whether they realize this themselves or not. Sometimes they do things without realizing what they are doing. So these two points are important. The enemy has targeted these two points, unity and security. We must confront it.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
It's just the kind of thing arms manufacturers want to hear. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky saying we are creating such a defense potential for Ukraine. His excitement was evident in this tweet, glorifying the military manufacturers, and that Ukraine is determining that. Finally, the truth is out in the open, normalizing war profiteering Zelensky style, and many would argue that was one of the goals of the U.S. in its proxy war with Russia. Except now, the Ukrainian president has turned Ukrainians into proxies of the military-industrial complex, as well as the Pentagon. Zelensky's sentiment was relayed while Kiev hosted 252, quote, defense industry corporations from 30 different countries. Zelensky urged the war profiteers to open factories in Ukraine to cut out the middleman. His speech included phrases like the defense industrial complex, arsenal of the free world, and a special economic regime for the defense industrial complex. Consider what the Ukrainian president is promoting. A war to the military manufacturers to show prospective buyers and investors how various military equipment can rip apart human bodies in order to profit from death and destruction. These are the gruesome stats so far. Over 27,000 Ukrainian casualties. Meanwhile, Russia's military casualties have approached 300,000. The Russian numbers dwarf the Ukrainian figures, which officials put at close to 70,000 killed and between 100,000 to 120,000 wounded. Perhaps like no other time, the war in Ukraine, which Russia calls a special military operation, finds itself at a crossroads.
The bill is passed, and without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
U.S. Congress just passed an 11th-hour funding bill that excluded aid for Ukraine. This means the U.S. president's hands are tied in order to keep the aid flowing, at least for now. To make matters worse, the Pentagon has said that there's only $5.2 billion left to provide military support for Ukraine. Additionally, the account that the U.S. used for a long-term program to modernize the Ukrainian army and to increase its compatibility with NATO is empty. On the surface, that may sound like a bad thing, but if you think about it, that's great news. Maybe the war may come to an end soon. That, however, depends on who you ask. The EU foreign policy chief is not too happy about the U.S. turn of events.
Our support to Ukraine not only continues, but increases. Or at least, by the time being, the proposition on the table shows that we want to continue in increasing it. And to tell the truth, we were surprised by the fact that the last minute agreement has taken a decision that we have to regret deeply.
Europe is reluctant for this war to end. It has believed the U.S. line that Russia poses an existential threat to it. This is part of the reason why the U.K. has announced that it will send military instructors to the country. It will also transfer training and production of military equipment to Ukraine.
We feel your pain.
There is one important fact behind this announcement, which was made by the UK Defense Secretary. The important point, that the UK will send military instructors to Ukraine, all to happen on Ukrainian soil. There's an American saying that says, war is a racket. And the US's Big Five is very well aware of that. They are Boeing, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon, who split more than $150 billion in Pentagon contracts annually. That's nearly 20% of the total Pentagon budget. Ever since the Ukraine war began, they have reaped huge profits and in turn have contributed to the US economy. Europe is following suit, and why shouldn't they? Their economies are not doing that well, and like the U.S., they want a piece of the pie. To manufacture weapons in Ukraine, in order to make up for some of the funds that they sent there. We mentioned the U.K. Germany's military manufacturer, Rheinmetall, has also announced that it will operate a maintenance plant in Ukraine. But Americans are angry. They want the support to stop.
It's the United States and NATO who are are to blame and the fundamental cause of the conflict in Ukraine, and that if we can force the U.S. government to stop sending money and weapons to Ukraine, the war will end the very next day.
And in Germany, EU's powerhouse, things are pretty bad when doctors protest the high cost of living.
The clinics have no choice but to protest because we have to make sure we have money by the end of the month to pay all the staff and house rent.
Two-thirds being in the affirmative, the rules are suspended. The bill is passed, and without objection, the motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
A U.S. government shutdown narrowly averted. This extension was more of a band-aid, since there's a strong possibility that lawmakers will find themselves battling it out in 45 days when the deadline arrives. However, what things the U.S. government spends its money on has been overlooked, which ironically should be the focus. Just take a look at these eye-popping figures. If there was a shutdown, soldiers would not get paid, and the ones on the bottom half of the social strata, especially ones getting government assistance and social services, would suffer. The government has averted a shutdown, but what about the wider U.S. economy? News making headlines in the U.S. are the auto workers' strike, which has expanded for the first time ever to include the Detroit Three. The union and the automakers remain far apart on key economic issues like pay.
We're not out here to grab headlines. You know, this isn't fun to us. We're not out here just for the heck of it. We're out here because GM and the three companies screwed around for over 7 weeks and didn't get into bargaining with us.
But the automakers did not reciprocate. Since 2013, they have raked in $250 billion in profits. That's $1.7 million that they made off each worker. Meanwhile, these are their CEO's salaries. Ford CEO Jim Farley, a modest $21 million per year. Stellantis CEO Carlos Tavares, $25 million per year. And General Motors CEO Mary Barra, who said she was extremely frustrated and disappointed by the strike, she makes $29 million per year. One automaker summed it up perfectly. I think people all around the country here are just getting fed up with corporations not sharing or including them into the profit or acknowledging our hard work that we put into the company. The stats confirm that sentiment. Between 1979 and 2022, the inflation-adjusted annual wages of the top 1% of workers rose by 145%, while the average annual wages of the bottom 90% rose by only 16%. In the U.S., while the number of strikes is relatively unchanged, the number of striking workers has beat prior years. Some 362,000 workers have gone on a strike so far in 2023, compared with 36,600 over the same period 2 years ago. Job security should be a concern for Americans. Corporate bankruptcies have soared to a 13-year high. The workers on strike, like many other Americans, complain that their wages have not kept up with inflation. The official inflation rate in the U.S. for 2023 reported to be 3%, with the pay increase to have been 5%, outstripping inflation. But that does not match what the average American is facing when it comes to things like groceries, energy, transportation, travel, and dining. Just take a look at these figures in this table, showing the types of inflation that Americans faced in 2022. Although inflation has decreased in 2023, it is not the 5% that the U.S. government has announced across the board. Perhaps that is why the U.S. is experiencing an increase in poverty, which in 2022 was 12.4%. That's an increase of 4.6 percentage points from 2021. And in terms of food assistance, another shocking figure, 41.2 million Americans, 12.5% of the total U.S. population, received monthly SNAP benefits in the 2022 fiscal year. The U.S. makes around $6.3 trillion in income, and believe it or not, spends half of that amount on entitlement programs like food assistance and benefits. This does not sound like a very healthy economy. A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis that mainly results from the government's economic policy is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. The results of the research were published by the BMJ Public Health Journal. The study showed that the cost of living crisis and sustained period of high prices will reduce life expectancy among the people across the country by 6.5% this year. The predicted increase in premature deaths from a baseline of 463 per 100,000 people to 493 per 100,000 equates to thousands of extra deaths a year in the UK. The study says that the most deprived households will experience four times the number of extra deaths than the wealthiest households, with the poorest having to spend a large proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Evidence shows low income is associated with poorer health, and that falls in income adversely affect health. According to last month's figures, the UK's inflation stood at 6.7%.
For me, this hunger conversation is about whether I heat the house or whether I breathe. And it's so hard to describe what that feels like in real terms, because it's an immediate threat to your life.
Although it was down from a high of 11.1%, Britain's inflation still remains the highest among the member states of the group of seven. Meanwhile, there are gloomy predictions about UK's economic prospects. A report by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says that the UK economy will shrink this year and in 2024. It says a drop in GDP this year of 0.3% would be followed by a fall of 0.2% next year.
Now, if we look at the data that we've seen recently, obviously there can be some revisions in the GDP data. We saw quite a contraction in July. Now, we are expecting, perhaps there are some quirks in the data that we haven't seen as much industrial action recently, and there could be some technical issues and a rebound. But I think the outlook for the rest of this year is quite weak. And we see that, as you've mentioned, in the PMI surveys, both manufacturing and services moving into contraction.
There are fears that the UK is suffering from structural economic conditions. Factors related to the underlying weakness of the UK economy and the fallout from Brexit will leave the UK behind, while most other developed economies expand. The UK was also suffering from an unequal recovery that benefited better-off households, while the bottom half of the income scale continued to be affected by falling real incomes. Persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in the drop in the country's gross domestic product. Cuts to government spending next year will also drag on economic growth. The central bank held rates at 5.25% at its meeting, and betting on financial markets showed investors expect there will be no change at the next meeting in November. The next move could be upwards should inflation prove to be more stubborn than the central bank's forecast predicts, despite a weakening of economic growth.
I think really what we're seeing is they are worried about the recession. They are worried about weaker growth, and they think that perhaps going into the rest of this year, inflation is likely to continue to decelerate. So what we're seeing is the lagged impact of fairly aggressive monetary tightening really starting to bite. And they're probably thinking, right, that here is a time to pause, but we don't want to get too complacent. There are still a lot of inflationary pressures ahead.
The economic crisis and persistent inflation has caused trouble for the ruling Tories in the UK. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's popularity has fallen to its lowest levels ever. Some 68% of Britons currently have an unfavorable view of the Prime Minister, the highest figure since becoming Prime Minister, while only 23% have a favorable view.
The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
Iran has vowed a resolute response to Israel after the regime's prime minister threatened to use nuclear weapons against the Islamic Republic. Amir Saeed Iravani said Israel's threat to use nuclear weapons is a serious threat to international peace and security, and the international community must not remain indifferent or silent. The Iranian envoy urged the United Nations Security Council to denounce Israel's reckless statement. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations has also denounced Israel's nuclear threat against the country. Zahra Ershadi has called on the international community to force the regime to abandon nuclear weapons, join the NPT, and accept the IAEA safeguard system.
The Israeli regime, with the support of the United States, has consistently opposed all initiatives aimed at establishing a nuclear weapon-free zone in the Middle East. The possession of hundreds of nuclear weapons by this regime poses a severe threat to the security of the Middle East and beyond. A vivid example of this regime's outlawed action is calling for a so-called, I quote, credible nuclear threat against Iran, end of quote, which was brazenly raised by the regime's prime minister on 22nd September 2023.
Ershadi slammed Tel Aviv's irresponsible threat, which he said was against international norms and rules. Days earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had addressed the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly, calling for a credible nuclear threat against Iran.
Sanctions must be snapped back. And above all, Iran must face a credible nuclear threat.
His office soon afterwards said that Netanyahu had misspoken and that his prepared text said credible military threat. Iran says the international community should reject and condemn any normalization of nuclear rhetoric and, in particular, the threat of use of nuclear weapons. Israel has a widely known but undeclared nuclear program. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, as of January, Israel was believed to possess a stockpile of around 90 nuclear warheads. But analysts believe the regime possesses 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the Middle East's sole possessor of non-conventional arms. The Tel Aviv regime has, however, refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. On the contrary, Iran has long been cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as a signatory to the NPT. Tehran has repeatedly declared that its nuclear program remains purely peaceful as always, and that the Islamic Republic had no intention of developing nuclear weapons as a matter of Islamic and state principles. Iran proved the peaceful nature of its nuclear program to the world by signing the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, with six world powers, but the United States later quit it. Ever since the Islamic Republic of Iran decided to restart its nuclear activities after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, it has faced consistent threats from Western nations and their regional allies, especially Israel. The Tel Aviv regime has launched sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinated its nuclear scientists. Several Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2020. Israel has pressed upon its allies that Iran's program is malicious, partly as a smokescreen for its own nuclear program and its scores of undeclared nuclear warheads.
What I call in English whistleblower, to inform the world about Israel's nuclear secret, because no one speak or no one report exactly what is going there.
In 1986, Vanunu duped Israel's vaunted security apparatus and smuggled a camera into the secret Dimona plant. His photographs exposed the world's greatest nuclear cover-up. What he showed was that Israel's nuclear arms program was far bigger and much more powerful than anyone had even dreamt possible.
Enough material every year for 10 bombs.
Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has campaigned against Iran for almost 30 years. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the Redeemer of human volition and thought.
We're waiting for you to be by your side.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of The Last Savior. Well, I am Asma. I'm your host for today's episode, and I hope you enjoy today's episode. Well, here with me, we have a brother, Alavi. He has a PhD of philosophy, and he's an Islamic researcher, so I guess today we're going to have a lot to learn from him. So, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
Well, previously on The Last Savior, we talked about our duties in the time of occultation. Well, we said that we cannot sit just idly and do nothing while we have too much of duties. Yes, we talked about the Mosque of Jamkaran, and we said that maybe in past, people did not have much of insight about this mosque, but then little by little, as time went on, I guess right now there is no one in this world who could claim that he or she does not have a knowledge about this mosque. But the thing is that there are many conjectures and thoughts over that. And there are some people who say if there's any document saying that this mosque is a holy place, or I don't know, going there has got some rewards or not, or things like that. So we would like you to just shed some lights over that.
Asking for proofs in all recommended actions is of no use.
Yeah.
Look, when, for example, you are going to enter a masjid here in our vicinity here in the place that now we are talking together, do you think it's quite wise to ask me that, can I enter this masjid or go and do and perform my prayers there or not? This is a masjid,
of course not.
A sacred place, and you go there, and it's based on your own taste to go into this masjid or not. Because this is a place that has been built for prayer as a masjid. Jamkaran is a masjid.
Just the house of God.
Yeah, the house of God. So to ask about a document, I don't know, a proof behind it that, okay, what are the proofs behind this Jamkaran? I think it's something in vain to search for the documents behind it. We have some hadith that are called, they are known and famous as the hadith man balagh, just for the reward that we might receive. For example, if we see a person in the street, or, for example, based on a duty that we have, we say salam to him.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, we understand that, wow, he was a criminal, and we were saying salam to him. Did we make a mistake? No, we performed our Islamic duty. We said salam.
Yeah.
And definitely we'll reach the thawab or the reward that has been given for this salam.
Exactly.
Right?
Second, you did what you had to do.
What we had to do. For example, there is a masjid called Jamkaran. Is it good to go there? Is it good to go to any masjid in the world?
Of course it is.
But for this masjid that became very important, and plenty of people in the last centuries until today have entered here and did lots of ibadah and worship and for such a long time. So I think only this ibadah itself gives this importance to this land, if there is no document and proof behind it.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have seen lots of good people, I mean, among the scholars and order people, went there, did lots of ibadah and worship, Baituta and whatever is known. For example, some did i'tikaf in the Ayyam al-Bid in the month of Rajab. So sometimes the ibadah of a person gives importance to the place, the land that he is in.
Exactly.
For example, the place that you are now living in, it was not, for example, a place, for example, a century ago.
Yeah.
Now, due to your ibadah, the ibadah of you and your family, that place becomes important because a believer, Muslim, is there and prays, five times prays at least, and the other people in your family. So this gives importance to that place.
So the worship that happens there gives it the importance that
definitely
it already has.
Moreover, we have seen the behavior and treatment of the scholars, like Ayatollah Burujerdi, like Ayatollah Bajar, the scholars, and the Ayatollah Safi, the late Ayatollah Safi. We have seen that they have gone there and they performed their prayers there.
Mm-hmm.
And they even ask people to go there and to perform their prayers there. Even once, a person asked Ayatollah Safi, the late Ayatollah Safi, that when we go to Jamkaran, should we perform our prayers with the intention of Raja or with the intention of Wurud. Raja and Wurud means, that is, it has been mentioned something in the hadith from the Ahlul Bayt and the infallible imams that it is recommended to say. He replied after pondering, he said, with the intention of Wurud. That is, there are some documents, there are some proofs behind it. Regardless of all those proofs and documents and narrations that come and has been narrated from the Masjid of Jamkaran, the Mosque of Jamkaran, so it's a sacred place, and it's good for us to go and pray there as well.
Exactly, just like every other.
This is a recommended mustahab action.
Yeah. So before we get into some more, let's go for a short break, and then we'll be back.
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old
Yes, we talked already about the Mosque of Jamkaran. Let's talk about the meaning of waiting for the promised Imam to come.
Actually, intidar, or waiting for the arrival and advent of Imam, has two meanings. One is a positive and the second is a negative. The positive meaning of intidar is to be waiting for a comprehensive humanistic system. The system in which you're waiting is the system that there is no fault and there is no deficiency in it. In the positive meaning of intidar and awaiting for the arrival of Imam is to wait for a comprehensive, faultless system that comes by an infallible person and is introduced to the whole world without any mistake. And it's 100% comprehensive and pure.
And it's all-inclusive.
And established based on justice.
Mm-hmm. It's not just for the Muslim people.
For the whole humanity.
Yeah. The entire humanity are waiting for someone to come and to just save them.
Mankind is in thirst of justice.
Yeah.
The whole mankind is actually looking for the justice. An enlightened system that actually looks for the rights of the people and annihilating the battle from the scene of the earth. So waiting in this worldview is very good and positive.
Exactly.
But does it nullify our duties?
Of course not.
Not. So we have.
Maybe it even doubles it.
So we are striving to reach to that level.
Mm-hmm.
We are not waiting for Imam just to come to solve all these issues.
Miraculously, everything is going to be solved over one night.
Definitely. So the opposite side is quite clear now. The negative meaning of intidar or awaiting of Imam alayhi salam. That is what? That is, we are silent towards any mistake, towards any weakness, towards any oppression.
Any tyrant, any...
And we are leaving the whole thing on the shoulder of Imam to come and solve it and resolve it. So we are doing nothing, just we are waiting for him to come and inshallah he will come and he will do everything. This is quite common, unfortunately, among even the Muslims. And unfortunately, to say more dreadfully, even among some of the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt.
But that's not true, because one of our duty is to pave the road for him to come.
That's it.
Yeah.
So we have to do our best. We have to strive. We have to perform our duty and prepare the world for him to come to finish the whole thing and to actually to sign it forever.
Just in order to get prepared for the last part of today's episode, we have to go for a short break. So, welcome back. Well, this is the last savior. We have been talking about our duties, and then we went through the whole idea of the Mosque of Jamkaran, and then also We are talking about the concept of awaiting at the time of occultation and what does it mean and the things just like that. So we said that the idea of waiting is not just to sit idle and then think that, okay, the promised Imam would come and solve everything miraculously as if just everything is going to happen just over one night and everything is going to change and it would be going happily ever after. It's not just like that. As a true believer who has been submitted himself or herself into this waiting, we have to pave the road for our Imam to come.
Very true. At the time of conquering of Mecca, the Prophet forgave all the Meccans. He said, "Antum al-talaqa, all of you are free."
Mm-hmm.
Except a very few number of people, two or three. One of them was a person who was involved in the martyrdom of Hamza Sayyid al-Shahada.
Yeah.
He fled and he escaped towards Yemen. And he was there for a long time. So when the Prophet came back to Medina and he understood that, okay, the Prophet and his companions actually have made a city-state in Medina and the people are following them. And he found that, okay, there is no way for him to come back to Mecca or Medina.
Yeah.
And he has to stay in Yemen forever. He decided to come to Medina and make some mediation through some people to tell the Holy Prophet that I made a mistake and forgive me.
Yeah.
Look, when he came back and through some people, he came in the Masjid al-Nabawi and he stood in front of the Holy Prophet. And as soon as the Prophet saw him, he actually put his head downwards. And he was waiting for something to happen. And
so he didn't even say a word?
No, the Prophet didn't say a word. And then he said, "You just go out of my eyes."
Yeah.
You are forgiven. Just be somewhere so that I don't see you anywhere.
Exactly.
And he was forgiven. The companions asked the Holy Prophet, "Why were you staying for a couple of minutes?" And he said, "Nothing." He said, "Because I was waiting for you to do something. You know what was my decree on this. You know that I said that he has to be killed. It's not my duty to come and kill him by myself. You see?"
Yeah.
He said, "I was waiting for you to do your action when I saw that you are not knowing about your action, your duties. So I forgive him."
Yeah.
"But I told him, just get out of my eye."
Mm-hmm. So since he's the paragon of kindness and compassion, he forgave him. But the duty of other people who were there was to just kill that.
And the duty was still there.
Yeah.
And the duty was still there. I mean, when the Prophet or the Imam says something, it's not only for a certain period of time.
Exactly.
It's like Al-Quran. I mean, they say because we said that they are together. It's like the Holy Quran. And what the Quran says, they are interpreters of the Holy Quran. If the Prophet or the infallible Imam says something, is the same way of the Quran. It's not going to be for a certain period of time.
Exactly. So it could be applied to nowadays as well. So if we see any tyranny, any oppression,
so we are going
we
to
have to just fight
leave the
back.
Burden of that oppression on the shoulder of Imam Mahdi, alayhi salam, for him to come to do everything. No.
Yeah.
He's waiting for us to come up and to do our duties. Then he knows what to do and he knows when to come.
Exactly. Yeah. So thank you, Brother Alavi.
Thanks to you.
Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us until another episode of The Last Savior. I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow? We'll be right back.
the last messenger of the heavens. Man was created on the morning of the sixth day. The time of worship commenced, and Adam began the rituals for his Lord. He, and after him,